Hi there. Welcome to the From Lab to Launch podcast by Qualio, where we share inspiring stories from the people on the front lines of life sciences. Tune in and leave inspired to bring your life-saving products to the world.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to From Lab to Launch by Qualio. I'm Meg, your host. Thanks for tuning in today. Before we jump in, we'd love it if you rated the podcast and shared it with any of your science nerd friends. We know you have some. If you'd like to be on the show, please fill out the application linked in the show notes. We're grateful for all the interest we've had lately. Today, our guest is David Schoniker, who is currently the president of Black Diamond Regulatory Consulting, a consulting firm specializing in providing regulatory and quality consulting for the pharmaceutical, dietary supplement, food, and related industries. The firm provides expert advice for difficult problems and training on excipient and food additive regulatory, quality, and supply chain concerns. With over 45 years of experience working in these areas, Dave has developed strong networks with trade associations, regulatory agencies, and pharmacopedias around the world. He is also an adjunct professor at Temple University School of Pharmacy in their RAQA master's program, teaching courses in global excipient regulations and the regulation of dietary supplements. Prior to this, Dave was the Global Regulatory Director of Strategic Relationships at ColorCon Inc. Without further ado, let's bring Dave in. Welcome, Dave.
How you doing, Meg?
Great. So to get us started, Dave, can you tell us about the start of Black Diamond Regulatory Consulting?
Sure. You know, I'm a big time skier and have a love of skiing all my life. And when I retired from ColorCon and started consulting, I was trying to figure out the name of my firm. And my daughter sort of gave me the idea of working something with my love of skiing into the name of the company. So anybody who's a skier understands what double black diamonds mean. And obviously, I have a fair amount of expertise in these areas that I like to be able to help clients with very difficult problems that they have, including the one that we're talking about today.
That's great. For our non-skiers, do you want to tell them what black diamonds mean?
Good point. Yeah. You know, black diamonds stand for expert trails. Double black diamonds, which is my logo, essentially, stand for, sort of super expert trails, some of the most difficult on the mountain.
Very good. So one of the things we keep hearing about in the news and our concerns around titanium dioxide in the news, can you tell us a little bit about what titanium oxide is and how it's used in the food and pharmaceutical applications?
Absolutely. Yeah. Titanium dioxide outside of water is probably the most used excipient in pharmaceutical formulations. It's also a big time ingredient in many food applications as well. It is a pigment. It is a white pigment. And it's got some very unique properties that really no other material that you can utilize in pharmaceuticals have the kind of properties that TiO2 has. And we'll talk about those as we go forward a little bit. But it tends to be used as not only a white colorant and white pigment, but an opacifier. So that even if you have different colors on a coating, let's say on a tablet or in a capsule, you need to opacify that color. And so, you know, to make it bright and also make it so that light doesn't just so it's not transparent, if you will. And that provides protection to pharmaceuticals in terms of light stability controls, et cetera. So, you know, TiO2 is one of the, what a lot of people tend to refer to is sort of one of the perfect excipients that have many different uses, not only for coloring and opacification in pharmaceutical products and food products as well, but also to really protect the API. So many APIs are light sensitive, and TiO2 is one of the main ways that you can protect the light sensitivity of the API. So it provides a lot of stability to drug products. Because of that, it's been used extensively in literally thousands of drug products all over the world and many, many food products and dietary supplement products as well.
Are there similar ingredients that can provide the same type of properties as titanium dioxide?
Nope. There is nothing that you can use in pharmaceuticals that comes anywhere close to the properties that you have with TiO2. There are some materials that can be used as alternatives in some cases, but they're by no means substitutes for TiO2, and they don't come close in terms of the opacification or light protection that they can provide. So the answer is really there aren't any real alternatives that are viable in all applications. In some cases, there might be materials that would provide something that I would call good enough, but certainly not the best in terms of their properties and the way they're used.
Okay, so this has really been the gold standard thus far.
Absolutely, and that's why it's been used all over the world in, you know, almost anything that, you know, has any kind of color in it, you know, whether it's white colored, you name it, if it's coated, if it's a capsule, any of that has TiO2 in it. Historically, it's been in most products on the market.
Interesting. So there's been a lot of news coming out of Europe. Can you explain what has happened there recently with titanium dioxide in foods?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of press that people hear about, and they only get one side of the story. And unfortunately, for the consumer out there who's not a toxicologist or a scientist, they don't always understand, you know, some of the details. But, you know, what has happened really, as far as I'm concerned, it's sort of a travesty what's happened in Europe, okay, is that, you know, the European Food Safety Authority was charged with reevaluating the safety of many different food and color additives. And back in 2016, they started a reassessment of titanium dioxide, and they looked at all the, you know, newer studies that were out there, et cetera. And their initial evaluation was, we don't see any problems with titanium dioxide. However, there's a few data gaps that we feel we'd like to fill. So they put out a call for data to the industry. The industry responded, spent millions of dollars on new studies to fill the gaps that EFSA, which is the abbreviation for the European Food Standards Authority, that EFSA requested, did every study they asked for, okay? And, supplied that data as it was coming together. EFSA looked at this and reassessed it several times. And during that process, there was a study that was funded by the French government in France had a very poor study design, should have never been considered as having any credible data, as far as I'm concerned, and as you'll hear many toxicologists all around the world. But unfortunately, in France, there's, I'll call it an over precautionary concern about the presence of nanoparticles and in many materials. And in titanium dioxide, there is a certain portion of the pigment that is nanoparticles. That's actually what gives it its unique properties. Without that, it wouldn't have the properties, right? So the other thing is those particles have always been present in the TiO2 that every person on the planet has been eating at significant levels or taking in drugs pretty much every day of their lives for the last 100 years without even one person ever having an adverse effect that's ever been tagged to titanium dioxide. However, this very poorly designed study in France indicated some potential concerns, and I won't go into the details here for this audience, but they indicated some potential concerns, which got a lot of media attention and a lot of political attention, especially in France, because they're worried about nanoparticles. Okay. So what happened was France believed there was a problem. Now, remember, the French government funded the study also. So that's important to stress. They funded a study and they had a poorly designed study that got a certain result on something that they were nervous about. Okay. So France basically wanted to ban the material based on this question that came up. They went to EFSA, who was reviewing all of this data during this reassessment. And even EFSA, the European Food Safety Authority, looked at the data from France and said, there is nothing here that we believe should change our position that TiO2 is safe. And in fact, we're going to continue its use and maybe ask for a few additional studies to fill some data gaps. Okay. Which industry did. Okay. EFSA continued to say it was safe. And they continued to say it's safe after multiple times that France asked them to reassess the data and new data, et cetera. Until, right towards the end, when everybody in industry was expecting that EFSA had completed their evaluation, that they were going to provide a acceptable daily intake for this material, which was what their goal was, they changed course at the last minute and basically said, well, we've now looked at all these studies on truly nano grades of TiO2 that actually have nothing to do with the pigment grades that we use in foods and pharmaceuticals. They're designed for catalyst use in the chemical industry. But they looked at that material and they said, oh, there's more data gaps now. And because we now have questions, we can no longer say TiO2 is safe. Okay. Now, again, that wording's important. Saying that we have data gaps and we can no longer say it's safe is not saying there's a safety problem. Okay.
Yes.
It's simply saying we have some uncertainty and some questions. Now, what they should have done is what they did back in 2016 or 17 when they asked the industry for more data to fill the data gaps. They didn't do that. They published their opinion and said, we can no longer say it's safe because there's data gaps. Well, the politicians in Europe took that to mean there's a safety problem. We have to ban this material. And very quickly moved towards banning the material. So this started in France. It became political. And what I would say, the term that I tend to use in a lot of my presentations on this is political toxicology got into the mix. Okay. And this really doesn't have anything to do with good science and a real safety problem. It has to do with what happens when negative media comes out that's not based on good science and it gets beyond the science. Okay. And so ultimately, after all of this, and I know I've gone through an extensive discussion here, but it's important because it sets up the rest of our conversation. Essentially, Europe decided to ban titanium dioxide for food uses because that's what they were evaluating it for. Okay. And that ban went into effect in 2021 for all food products that could no longer be made with titanium dioxide in the European market. And that required companies to have to do massive reformulations of many, many different food products. And in many cases, the products that used alternatives, maybe were, again, I'll call it good enough, but not necessarily as good as what they could be with titanium dioxide. Now, the food industry is a lot different than the drug industry, but I wanted to answer your question about foods and what happened in Europe so far.
Are there any really good studies that address or identify safety concerns with the use of titanium dioxide in foods and drugs? Is there anything on
Well, that's a really good question. And when you look at it, there are, you know, especially since this happened, obviously more studies were done, both by the industry, by people who, you know, the NGOs and other groups that are now fired up against this material, et cetera. And you will find that there are some studies out there that, you know, claim there's some issues, but we've looked at these in detail. And essentially, there is no good design study that has any scientifically credible information that actually shows a real safety concern. There are many new studies that the industry has funded to answer those uncertainties and those questions that came up, and those studies are underway, and some of them have been completed. And of course, you know, they show what we expected, that there's no problem. Now, there's some still going on, but there was a specific study that was done at University of Nebraska. And Michigan State University ran a major study. Basically, the study in France that started all this was the author's name was Bettini. So we call it the Bettini study. Okay. So what Nebraska and Michigan attempted to do was to try to see, could they replicate what happened in that study to see whether or not actually there was an issue or not. Okay. Which is, you know, what you do with good science. You try to make sure that, you know, that you can replicate these things. They put together an extremely well-designed study to try to answer all the questions about that Bettini study as to whether, you know, we should trust it or not. Right. And I'm happy to say, after Nebraska and Michigan finished their study, it came out totally clean, not validating any of the results that Bettini had, or any of the question marks that Bettini had brought up in his paper, or their paper, I should say. And so, you know, that's just one study that is out there and that's published. And there's been several others done, and they all keep coming up clean. Now, this is not a surprise. I said this material has been ingested by probably every human on the face of this earth for their entire lifetime, with no effects that anybody's ever actually seen. So, you know, short answer to your question, no, there's no credible science that justifies that there's actually any safety problem with TiO2. Now, unfortunately, because of the way the media has gotten out on this, a lot of people don't believe that. You know, there's a lot of, I'll use today's vernacular here. There's a lot of fake news out there about TiO2, but at the end of the day, there is no real safety problem with this material that's been demonstrated. And there are continuing ongoing studies to continue to reassess that, reevaluate, and verify that that's true.
So thinking of the food ban in Europe, does that have any impact on dietary supplements?
Yes, it does. Pretty much all dietary supplements in Europe are considered food products. So this automatically had an impact on all dietary supplement products that are marketed in Europe. Again, a lot of people had, they had to do one of two things. They had to either try to reformulate to something as best as they could with the alternatives, but that doesn't always work. Okay. And in other cases, products were withdrawn and essentially no longer marketed in Europe, still could be marketed in most other places in the world. But, they lost access to some of those products because there was no economics that would drive that kind of reformulation effort for certain types of products. So there's already been an impact in Europe on dietary supplements.
And we expect to see further impact on pharmaceuticals next?
Well, that's the big hinging question right now. Because what happened was when this ban was put in place in Europe, it was put in place specifically for foods. But the question got brought up by the politicians and the NGOs. Okay. Hey, this stuff is used in medicines too. We should ban it there as well. And fortunately, the European Medicines Agency, realized the impact this would have on pharmaceuticals, which we'll talk about is huge. Okay. And they gathered information from industry and from other sources and basically went to the European Commission before this decision was made and said, look, you know, there is lots of information showing that this would create a lot of issues for pharmaceuticals. We don't know if it's even possible, what the impact would be, what the potential implications to drug shortages and everything else would be. And so they basically asked for a delay to allow for further evaluation. So what happened was when the European Commission banned TiO2 for foods, they basically gave a 3-year extension for pharmaceutical use of TiO2. To allow the EMA to gather further information from the industry and their own sources as to what the impact would be to try to extend this ban to titanium dioxide and whether it was feasible or not feasible, et cetera. They, however, basically said during that time period, they encouraged the industry to, you know, look for alternatives, try to use the alternatives, try to move away from TiO2. Again, all this is based on the fact that there's really no safety issue, but they were encouraging this because of this belief. Remember this became very political, not based on science at several points. And essentially, we're encouraging industry to do everything they can, okay? So we're in that time period right now. And essentially what will happen is the European Medicines Agency is currently gathering information. Industry and others are supplying a lot of answers to questions that they have and supplying information about, what really are the issues with trying to use alternatives? Are they even possible in some of these applications? And then ultimately, what would be the impact on the drug supply if somebody tried to go forward with a ban in Europe on this? And so that the timing on that is that the European Medicines Agency must supply a report to the European Commission by April of 2024 with a recommendation as to whether or not they feel that the ban should be extended to pharmaceuticals or not.
All right. That's less than a year away. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Oh, yeah.
As far as alternatives, what I know we said not much exists. Is there anything that they can use as an alternative in drug formulations, or do they need to think about changing packaging?
Well, good question. And you know, like I said, there are some alternatives that people have been exploring. A lot of work is going on in this area, you know, to try to find something in case a ban would happen. You know, probably when you look at the alternatives, probably one of the best alternatives, and it's not good, don't get me wrong, but one of the best alternatives are things like calcium carbonate, okay? In some applications where you're going to have a color involved, iron oxides can sometimes be utilized. There are some other materials, certain types of rice starches, something called isomalt, some tricalcium phosphates. These are all materials that people have been trying to use or use in combination to try to simulate the properties of TiO2 to the best degree possible. Now, that said, just to give you an idea of the difference, I said calcium carbonate probably has the best opacification properties next to TiO2 of the things that are available. Now, again, we're only talking about ingredients that are approved for use in foods and drugs, not pigments used in the paint industry or, whatever. To give you just an idea, there's something we call contrast ratio, right? Which really tells you sort of how opaque something is. And if you look at titanium dioxide, and the way you measure this is you make up a coating, you make a drawdown on a card that's white on the top and black on the bottom. And then you look for what the differences are where you see the break. You know, how opaque, do you see that black under there or not? And there's a way of measuring that with a spectrometer, and you determine that what's called this contrast ratio. And so a titanium dioxide has a 90% contrast ratio, which means it's almost totally opaque, okay? Calcium carbonate, next best thing, 12. Okay.
Wow.
So you're talking like 10 times less, 9 or 10 times less in terms of opacity. So you can start to see where if you're going to try to use that as an alternative, you're not going to have any of that same kind of opacification. So to give you an idea of what that actually means in practice is if you're using, let's say you're making a pharmaceutical tablet. And, most tablets these days have coatings on them with colors or whites or whatever. Almost all of them have titanium dioxide, unless they've been developed very recently with somebody trying these alternatives, okay? A typical weight gain of the film coating on a tablet would be what's called a 3% weight gain, right? So, and with a titanium dioxide coating, you can get by with only adding a 3% weight gain, and it gives you total opacification to anything that's underneath. And why is that important? Many tablets are colored or have speckles or, whatever. Like if you break a tablet open, it's not always white. Sometimes it is, right? If it's white, those are the cases where maybe the alternatives might work because you don't need as much opacity. But a lot of tablets might be yellow or brown or speckled. Think of a vitamin tablet, many times they're very speckled, et cetera. And so you have to hide that. You have to have opacification so you don't see the color, but also you're providing appropriate opacity to give light protection to that API, which is the most important part of this, right? If you get away, and most people do, with a 3% weight gain of a typical titanium dioxide coating, if you have a calcium carbonate coating, some of the best ones that have been developed to date by some of the best companies, you're probably talking anywhere from an 8 to 10% weight gain you're going to have to put on to even get close to what you had with titanium dioxide. It's still not going to be as good, but you might, depending on the surface of the tablet, you may get by, okay? Now, think of that. You get by now with 3% weight gain of the coating, and now you're talking, let's say, 8 to 10%. Like three times the amount of the coating has to be added, okay? That means it takes you three times as long to make the product. It changes the thickness of the coating by three times, okay? So all of your analytical methods that you had, and this might tie into Qualio as well, all the analytical methods that are validated, okay, on drug products today, throw them out the window because they're based on the tablet that exists today. If you change an existing product to now have three times as much coating, most of your dissolution methods, most of your analytical methods, your assays, everything is going to have to be redone, revalidated. So think of that implication. Mm-hmm. You're going to have all these manufacturing time, costs and implications that go in. And you're going to have stability implications because many times if you do have a light sensitive API, you might have to shorten the shelf life. Okay. So all of those sort of negative implications, you know, from an operational standpoint with material would come into play. And at the end of the day, you still have a product that is not going to be of the quality that existed before, but you're going to have put an awful lot more cost into it, which of course is going to have an impact on drug pricing, right? And you know, obviously right now, nobody wants to hear about drug pricing going up. I guarantee you that's what'll happen if this ban were to take place.
So that's one impact on patients in the pharmaceutical industry. You know, analytical methods that are validated getting thrown out the window, prices going up. What other impacts would we expect to see if this ban were to take place?
Well, this is the scary part, okay? Because the bottom line is just in Europe alone, there are 91,000 drug products on the market today that contain titanium dioxide. 91,000. Okay. Just think of that. Okay. Now, if TiO2 were to be banned, that means that 91,000 drug products have to be reformulated. Okay. Now you think in the drug world, what it takes to reformulate an existing product. Okay. Not only redoing all the developmental work, the stability work, the validation work, all the analytical validation work, then you've got the regulatory filings. All of these changes would be a qualitative and quantitative change to the formulation, which means in Europe, that probably would be a type 2 variation. Okay. Type 2 variations are significant regulatory submissions, post-approval change submissions, and even have a fee. To do one, it costs $103,000. Just for a fee for getting EMA to look at it. Now that's just a filing, not all the costs of doing all the studies and the revalidation. Okay. So, 91,000 products would have to go through that. Now, the big question comes, well, what would that really mean then in terms of cost? Well, some analysis has been done on that. The expectation would be it would cost between €1 and €1.5 million for every product that you would have to reformulate if you can. And remember, some of these products you're not going to get, you're not going to be able to reformulate and get a same product, right? I've talked primarily about immediate release applications. If you start thinking about modified release applications, most of them depend on the coating, or at least a lot of them, to release the drug. So now if you start putting more coating on, you can't achieve the same release rate, right? So there's technical implications, but then you get into all of these operational and stability related things, filing costs, et cetera, 1 to 1.5 million euros per product. So if you were actually going to try to reformulate all 91,000 drug products, that even was possible, okay? You're talking about approximately $32 billion that it would take to make this change, okay? $32 billion. Now, I guarantee you there are an awful lot of medical issues we have out there that could provide a lot more patient safety benefits for $32 billion than spending it on something where there's absolutely no improvement in safety risk to the patient, which is what would happen here. Okay.
Yeah.
So the reality, getting back to your question, those are the facts. Okay. That's what it would take if there were to be a ban. The big question comes, if you're a pharmaceutical company, are you going to reformulate? Okay. And, the economics are going to have to work. The economics ultimately will dictate whether somebody reformulates or not. Okay. And I guarantee you many products, there will be no economics to drive such an expense. Okay. Especially if TiO2 continues to be approved in other parts of the world. Okay. Where the product you currently have, there's no problem. Right. So are you going to really reformulate and have a separate product for the European market? Go through all this expense? No. The answer is you're only going to reformulate products where it makes economic sense. And what that means is many of your older products, many of your low margin products, many of your niche products, your orphan drugs, drugs for pediatrics and elderly that are small volume products, there's going to be no economic justification. Those products will simply be withdrawn. And I can tell you, I've talked with many companies because I'm very much in the middle of this whole thing. Many companies are pretty certain they would be withdrawing products if, in fact, this happened. So what does that mean? We're going to start off with a situation where there's a perceived safety risk, which is not true. There is no safety risk. And we're going to turn it into a real safety risk where now we have patients that can't get their medications in Europe, okay, and potentially elsewhere. Okay. Because even if it continues to be acceptable in other parts of the world, if you're a major global drug company and you have a smaller volume product and all of a sudden you take the European market out of the equation and that amount of sales, if you will, it may be that it's no longer viable economically for you to continue making that product, even for the other markets where you don't have to reformulate it because there's not enough, you know, volume to drive producing that product and having a plant dedicated to it, et cetera. So you could see people around the world lose access to products who their government doesn't have any problem with TiO2, but because of what Europe does, it could impact a lot of people globally. So that's really the key when it comes to your question about impact. There's lots of technical implications, regulatory filing implications, but the real issue is patient access to drugs is going to be limited. And then one last thing I'll mention, then I'll shut up for a minute. Let's get another question. Is the real question too is, let's just think about that number again, 91,000 drug products, okay? How many regulators is EMA going to have to hire to review 91,000 variation submissions, okay? There's been some estimates done that even if they doubled their workforce, it would probably take them 12 years to go through that many drug applications. Okay. And so, and of course, that's meaning that like everybody's dedicated to doing these change evaluations. What's going to happen to new drug demand? All the new drugs, does that mean some of them are now going to get delayed? You could have people losing their life because they don't have access to new drugs because instead, people are looking at these variations and it's delaying the approval of new drugs. All of these things are potential, impacts that this could have. So, now you kind of can understand my earlier comments. This issue is huge. And, if there was an actual safety issue with TiO2 that was credible, we all would be having a different conversation. We would all be saying, we got to do whatever it takes. We got to get it out of there. but that's not true. When in fact, there's no good science that really justifies this, to even be having this discussion is to some degree ludicrous when you think about the implications that it would have in the pharmaceutical arena, which is obviously a lot more significant than in the food arena, where, you know, if you lose a food product or you come up with a new and improved, it's a different color, it's a different product. I mean, that happens more routinely in the food industry, doesn't have the same implications of patients losing their life-saving drugs.
Absolutely. Yeah. Scary to think of the impact there with very little evidence behind it.
Absolutely.
So switching gears back to, you know, the U.S. and what's going on here in California, my former home state, we hear about lawsuits and bills that have been proposed requesting the ban of the same titanium dioxide in just California, which, well, honestly, California doesn't surprise me.
Yep. Well, exactly. And again, this is the effect of the media again. And let's talk for a minute really about global, you know, what do global regulators think about this, right? We've talked about what's happened in Europe, what's happening in Europe or just being discussed. A lot of times I get asked, well, you know, how does the FDA feel about that? How does other regulators in other countries feel about that? Well, the answer to that is the FDA has done their own thorough evaluation of this, and they don't have any safety concerns. And in fact, they have provided public statements showing that they actually think that the whole approach that EFSA used was incorrect. Okay, so FDA in the U.S. has no concerns about TiO2 in terms of their evaluation. And they did do a very recent evaluation of not only all the data that EFSA looked at, but all the new data that's been coming out as well. And they, right off the bat, I mentioned earlier how EFSA had looked at these nano grades that don't really have anything to do with TiO2. FDA looked at what they did there and said, well, no, that's not relevant because that's not the material we're talking about. You can't look at data gaps on a material just because it's supposedly the same chemical, but it's not the grades that have anything to do with the material that you're using here, and apply that because it's apples and oranges, right? So FDA made it clear that when they looked at the studies on the pigment grades of TiO2 and taking everything into consideration, they didn't have a concern. Same thing in health, in Canada, okay? Health Canada actually went one step further. Not only did they do a very thorough scientific evaluation of this, they published a large report. I forget how many pages it is, 50 to 100 pages. It's a big report, basically on the safety of TiO2. And after their assessment, basically came down as saying, we don't see any concern with the safety of TiO2. And, much like FDA, disagreed that looking at these nano grades should not be part of the consideration. It, you know, from a toxicology standpoint, it's kind of irrelevant information. And so Health Canada also said, we have no intent to take any action against TiO2. In a published report that's out there online, Australia, New Zealand, their regulatory agency called FSANS, also did their own evaluation here. Same thing, published a report online. We've looked at all the details. We don't see any issues. And interestingly enough, in the UK, the Food Standards Authority, which after Brexit, you know, the UK is now on their own. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily have to just go along with Europe all the time. They do their own evaluations. The Food Standards Authority did their own evaluation after what EFSA did, and came to a different conclusion as well. And they basically said, no, you know, we don't see a safety problem with TiO2. But they actually went one step further in the interim report that they published. They're going to have a final report coming out next month, but they published an interim report and they actually were extremely critical of the entire approach that EFSA took and basically said they felt that what EFSA has done is unnecessarily concerned the public over a situation that should have never, you know, been put out this way. It was rather interesting to see how critical they were in their report of EFSA, which they used to be part of. But that kind of tells you, you know, nobody else in the major countries have a concern. And in Japan, There's a new study that just came out recently. It's in the process of being published, where they actually looked at even the nanoparticles that are smaller than the ones that EFSA was worried about. And that study was well designed, came out totally clean. And in Japan, they also have said they don't have any concern. They're going to go through a formal evaluation, but based on what they know right now, they don't see any concerns. So major countries, no problems. There are a few countries that tend to be following what Europe does. They don't really have a large set of toxicology experts on board, so they tend to go along with Europe, et cetera. And so we've seen some of the Middle Eastern countries also put forward a ban. Basically, when you look at what they've said, they said, well, we're doing it because Europe did it, right? Not because they found more science, okay? We've had some discussions through the USDA Foreign Agriculture Service and the WTO with those countries. And actually, some of those countries are now thinking of possibly holding off and pausing the ban, okay? Down in South America, ANVISA, shortly after EFSA came out with their opinion, ANVISA sort of had a knee-jerk reaction, saying, well, maybe we should do it too, like Europe's doing it. But we sent them a lot of information with some of these facts and what other regulators were saying, and they've now sort of gone quiet. So nothing's happening there yet. So the big thing is the Joint Expert Committee on Food Additives, which is the global group that assesses the safety of food additives. They're part of WHO and FAO. They have taken on to do a global safety evaluation of all this data. They put out a call for data. Everybody sent them all the information, including all this new information. They are currently doing an evaluation. They will have a meeting in September or October, I forget this year, where they're going to be doing their own assessment, and then they will publish a JECFA opinion, which will represent sort of the world-class toxicologists from all over the world. So what we've tried to be telling a lot of these other countries is don't go and just ban it because Europe did. Wait and see what JECFA has to say. These are the world's best toxicologists. And then based on what they say, make appropriate decisions. So, you know, a lot of countries seem to be in that mode now where they're going to wait to hear from JECFA, which is exactly what they should do. That's why we have JECFA, to make these kinds of decisions. So that's all in the process. Now, getting back to your initial question about California, okay? That's another interesting situation, to say the least. And you said you lived in California before. Where did you live in California?
I grew up outside LA.
Okay. Well, and as you know, California always tends to have, let's just say, a little bit of a different view on things. Prop 65, you name it. It's always a little bit, you know, over the top on some of these things. Compared to some other states, right? So what's happened, two things started that got news media attention, okay? There was a couple of lawsuits that came out last year, one against Skittles and another on Tylenol, that, you know, basically what the people filing the lawsuit said was, well, you know, Europe has banned this material and these companies that make these products don't have a warning label on their containers. It contains, and they called it this toxic material called titanium dioxide. Now, nobody has called it toxic material. And certainly even what EFSA said never alluded to that, but that's what these lawsuits said. And basically, they were trying to sue these companies for, you know, putting their consumers at risk, not having warning labels and stuff. Well, long story short, the Skittles lawsuit was thrown out. Pretty much the same thing for Tylenol, but it got a lot of media attention. Okay. And of course, if you talk to the consumer on the street, you know, a lot of people come up to me. Oh, they hear I'm involved. Oh, what about these Skittles? Right. And it's like, I eat Skittles all the time. I will continue. There is no issue with Skittles, right? Or any other of the food products of many, which contain TiO2 as well as the drugs. However, what's now happened is the NGOs who basically want to do away with all food additives, pretty much, they don't like any of them. They hooked onto this issue, and there's a particular assemblyman in the state assembly in California who it was on a mission to get rid of some of these additives. Titanium dioxide is one of five additives that he has a concern about. And of course, when you dig into this bill that he has proposed, you will find that there are several NGOs that are the ones that are doing things around the country on this now, who are trying to get rid of these additives, right? For, you know, no good scientific reason, realistically, even though I think they think there is. Unfortunately, this assemblyman in California put forth a bill to ban these five additives, of which TiO2 is one of. Human foods. Now, this is not a medicine thing, at least yet, in foods. And unfortunately, he was very convincing, and he got the House to approve the bill, or not the House, the Assembly. Okay, now that bill has moved to the Senate in California, where there's going to be hearings that start, I forget, it's either this week or next week on this bill. And of course, we're all trying to provide them with a lot of the facts behind this and some of the things I've talked about with you today, to hopefully convince the Senate not to go forward with this, okay? Because if you look at this, this is a whole different issue. Now, if California actually did ban this in foods, you would have one state in the country that doesn't allow all the food products that all the other states allow, okay? How is that going to work from a trade perspective? You know, are companies really going to reformulate products just for California? Okay, it's an important market, but, you know, so that's sort of a strange situation. And if you really look at this, this is a total affront to FDA authority on protecting the public and food safety regulation. Okay, the FDA has the federal authority to do these types of evaluations, and the FDA has basically said, we don't see a problem. Okay. And we did evaluate recently all the new data. The bill says the FDA hasn't looked at this since the 60s. Not true. They simply don't know that the FDA has this, right? But they passed it anyway in the assembly, right? So, if this gets approved, it will be the first time that any state has actually banned something that FDA has said they don't have a problem. And you can start thinking about the difficulties that that may cause, especially in today's world. If certain states start saying, well, we can do whatever we want to do, regardless of what the FDA says. And of course, these NGO groups that are behind this have taken the same bill and they started the similar bill. They found a congressman in New York and one in New Jersey to try to have the same sort of bill. Now, those bills haven't really moved at all yet, like the California one is, and hopefully won't, because they're not based on any kind of good science. But you could start to see where you could have this patchwork of regulation that would be, from an industry perspective, impossible to support. And like I said, it's a direct challenge to FDA authority, which could start to affect, you know, drug approvals and all kinds of other things. If FDA is no longer the authority that everybody goes to for these kinds of decisions. So it's got a lot of other hidden implications that are not just this one case.
Yeah. What can industry do to fight these non-scientific precautionary bans across states and countries and try to continue the use of titanium dioxide, which really seems important to our drug product quality in our food industry?
Yeah, no, it's a difficult situation, I'll be honest with you, because when you get this negative media attention that the NGOs have been able to stimulate here, even in the U.S., and certainly it's what happened in Europe before the science started to, you know, kicked in, if you will. All you can try to do is educate, try to bring the real science forward, run additional studies that in fact may answer any uncertainty questions that are out there. But the difficulty we have is that once it gets out into the media and into some of this arena, science no longer matters. truth and facts no longer matter, as we've seen with many things, right? And that makes it very difficult to get the messaging to the consumer who ultimately is believing what they're hearing sometimes. And so, but that said, you know, there are many efforts to do exactly what I just talked about, right? The industry has put together a major new science program to run, you know, again, millions of dollars of new studies to answer any possible uncertainty that anybody still has and all the things that have been brought up. Those studies are underway. We've got various industry groups, which I'm involved with almost all of them, you know, that have formed different coalitions and, you know, joint association groups, et cetera, where we're sharing information and we're trying to utilize this to make sure we're bringing all the facts forward to the regulators around the world who are making decisions on this and try to start figuring out what kind of messaging can we put together in a way that can get to consumers as well. We've been having conferences. I just coordinated a big conference in Washington, D.C. last week where world-class toxicologists all came in to talk about the real safety situation, the impacts this would have if we went to pharma. And we have we're putting together a whole white paper coming out of that conference to try to, again, bring these facts forward to EMA so they're aware of the reality of what a ban would mean so that they think about that before they make a decision. So there's many things in the works, you know, to try to affect the outcome and hopefully not see, you know, this impact pharmaceuticals anywhere, including Europe. It may be too late to sort of save the food situation in Europe, because it's politically difficult for them to go back on this at this point. But certainly what we're trying to do is also influence with facts and science regulators in the rest of the world, not just to blindly follow Europe, but to, in fact, see what JECFA says based on good science and world-class experts and use that information to base their decisions on.
That's great, Dave. Glad you're involved on the front lines on this issue. Do you have any final thoughts on the titanium dioxide situation?
Yeah. What I would say to sort of finish off the discussion is here, unfortunately, I wish it was just a titanium dioxide situation, but actually this is the tip of the iceberg. Okay. Because what's happened now is many materials that are common food additives and pharmaceutical excipients contain a certain portion of nanoparticles. France, as I mentioned earlier, is overly worried, in my opinion, about nanoparticles. Okay. They have put together a list of 37 food additives, and many of them also are major pharmaceutical excipients, okay, that are known to contain or thought to contain nanoparticles at some level. And they want all of those materials to go through the same evaluation by EFSA in the same way that EFSA did it, using the same approach that they used, looking at this concern. And that's on the horizon. So what happens with titanium dioxide is going to set a precedent that could potentially impact many of the most important excipients that we have in the pharmaceutical industry and also in the food industry, for similar reasons. Okay. And just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, you remember those alternatives that I talked about that people are looking at to try to use in place of TiO2, calcium carbonate, iron oxides, tricalcium phosphate, isomalt. Guess what? All of those are on the French list of 37. Okay.
Oh, no.
So all of those, in fact, iron oxide is already under evaluation. And I can tell you, iron oxide does contain nanoparticles. There are no real, you know, safety issues that have ever been documented with it, but there are, you know, some of the, you know, when you start looking at these nano things that people worry about that go beyond science sometimes, some of the same concepts might come up in some people's minds. And so, you know, these materials are going to get looked at by EFSA. And if the same approach is used, there's certainly the possibility that some of those materials could go through the same kind of situation. Think about the implications. If the industry actually did reformulate thousands of products and millions or billions of dollars, and regulators, you know, spent all this time to substitute or try to utilize, calcium carbonate alternative, even though they're going to have what I'll call a second class product at the end. Okay. If they do all of that, only to find that 2 or 3 years later, calcium carbonate or iron oxide or one of the alternatives that they've now used is got the same problem. Now think about what the implications that would have, right? And again, like I said earlier, if there actually was a safety problem that's been demonstrated, we'd all be having a different discussion. That's simply not the case here, much to the NGO's chagrin. There's just no science backing up their arguments on this. I talk about like these pigment type materials that are used as alternatives to TiO2, but let me just throw out a couple other excipients that people who might be listening to this might, somewhat important to pharmaceuticals. Microcrystalline cellulose happens to have nanoparticles and is on the French list. Magnesium stearate, on the French list. Mannitol, on the French list. I could go on, okay? Microcrystalline cellulose and magnesium stearate, probably the most used fillers and lubricants in the entire pharmaceutical industry. Think of what would happen if the same thing happened to them, right? So again, this is something where we need to find a way. We need to pull out the stops. Everybody in the industry needs to get together, advocate, do studies, do whatever we have to do, lobby, etc., to make sure that science somehow prevails, as opposed to this overly precautionary thinking that is based on the precautionary principle, which is commonly used in Europe, especially in France, when we look at this. Otherwise, we're going to have problems that go way beyond what we're talking about today. And this, again, could be, like I said, the tip of the iceberg. And so we've got to find a way to nip this in the bud and get science to win, and not just media and politics dictating where all this ends up going. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, and this will be my last comment, patients are at risk here. Patient safety and availability of life-saving drugs is what this is really all about. And patients will suffer if there were to be a ban. People might think taking this nasty stuff out of the drugs is going to somehow benefit them. There will be no benefit, even if you do reformulate, because there's no risk in the first place. However, there'd be a significant risk if you can't get your drugs.
Or you can't afford them.
Or if you can't afford them. And, we talked about availability here, but you're right, the cost issue. Think of, if it does cost you $1 to $1.5 million to reformulate, who do you think is going to pay for that? Do you think the companies are just going to absorb all that? No. Drug prices will go up, and that's anti what everybody wants, including the government, right? That needs to be thought about. We see all the pressure here in the U.S. as well about lowering drug costs. What would
this
happen?
This is counter to that.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about even the politicians who sort of drove some of this in Europe in terms of the ban, okay, they probably thought this is what would get them votes with the voters because, we're keeping this nasty stuff out of your food products. Okay. That's a kind of short-term thinking, I think, because if you're that politician and all of a sudden it comes out in the media that your decision on this is now the reason that all of your voters can no longer get their drugs, I have a feeling that what they thought was a good idea is not going to get them elected in the long term, because not having access to these drugs, which will happen, by the way. Okay. I mean, the one thing I can say that I can absolutely say I'm certain of is 91,000 drug products will not be all reformulated. That is simply not going to happen. It's not even possible for that to happen. So if that's true, what does that mean? There will be drug shortages, probably on many drugs, more than there are today. And that's one of the biggest problems you hear about these days. Talk to a doctor. you know, and I plan to talk to doctors and nurses and others about this. What do you think this? You know, how would you like this to have this effect? We need to get them on board, and we plan to.
That's great. And so normally we wrap this podcast with a question about where we would find you in a bookstore. But as we're both skiers, I thought I would ask, what slopes would I be most likely to find you on this next ski season?
Good question. Well, I'm actually running a big trip for the Eastern Pennsylvania Ski Council to Val Gardena, Italy, in the Dolomites in the beginning of March, this coming ski season. So I'd love to see you in the Dolomites. That's certainly one place I'll be. And then the other big trip I have that I'm assistant trip leader on is a big trip for our council to go to Heavenly out in Lake Tahoe. So I'll be going out to California as well. And hopefully I'll be able to have, you know, my food with TiO2 in it when I get there. I'll be skiing in beautiful Lake Tahoe as well. How about yourself? Do you have something planned?
I ski here locally in Colorado. Steamboat Springs. That's on my list here. One of my last ones I haven't done here in Colorado.
Oh, you haven't done Steamboat yet?
I haven't done Steamboat yet.
You've got to do that. Actually, in 2025, we'll be running a trip to Steamboat. So maybe run into you out there then.
Yeah, and we can catch up on the latest on titanium dioxide then.
Absolutely. And hopefully we'll have more positive news to talk about at that point.
Yes. Well, it's been enlightening conversation today, Dave. I really appreciate you joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity to talk to you about this topic. As you can tell, I'm a little bit passionate about it because I've seen what the downside of this could be. And it's a serious issue that unfortunately not everybody in the pharmaceutical industry really understands what's going on yet and the implications it could have. So we're trying to get everybody, you know, fired up on this issue to understand the facts and everybody get together and get aligned on how we can make sure this goes down the right path.
Right. If our listeners want to learn more or get involved, where can they go to learn more about you and Black Diamond Consulting and how to get involved in titanium dioxide?
Well, the easiest thing to do would be to go to my website, which is https://, like normal, and then just blackdiamondregulatory.com.
We'll post that in the show notes. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dave.
Great. Thank you very much for the opportunity. And again, for those of you who were listening to this, hopefully this was educational to you and brought some things to light that maybe you didn't fully understand. And if you do want more information, please let me know. I'd be glad to help you with that.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of From Lab to Launch, brought to you by Qualio. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and give the show a positive review. It really helps us out. For more information about Qualio, our guest today, or to be a guest on a future episode, please refer to the show notes. Until next time.